Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined today by two good friends, Jay Cost, editor, contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, and author of a couple of books on American politics, most recently A Republic No More, and Spence Abraham, a former senator from Michigan, energy secretary in the George W. Bush cabinet, and Michigan State Republican chairman, so a real and pollster before that. So two people very experienced with presidential campaigns, and the point here as we speak, which is Monday afternoon, right after South Carolina, Monday, February 22nd, Washington's birthday, is just to try to analyze where we've been, where we are, where we're going. Pretty wacky year, right?
I think very unpredictable. I think if you know, we've had a couple of these conversations, and certainly where we thought things were headed.
No one should go back and look at them.
I mean, I'm not sure the buildup that was just given was earned by our most recent appearances, but it's definitely a surprise. I think most people thought at this point it'd be a very different race, but it's now a different field, a smaller field on the Republican side. And
so where are we? We're 3 weeks in and three contests.
Right.
And who's...
Well, I think if you were to... At least my sense is that Donald Trump is very strong. He's been able to hold most of the support his polls have demonstrated he has. Run very strongly on primary days, maybe not quite as strongly on caucus days. But he is the front runner. I think... If I were weighting it right now, I would say that the odds are more in his favor to be the nominee. Maybe not 50% yet, but closing toward that. And I think there may be in second place. I'd put a deadlock convention, and then I think Rubio and Cruz to be heard from more, and maybe that'll change the equation.
Jay, do you agree with that?
I don't know. This is the year where
historical
precedents are sort of colliding, right? You would think that on paper, somebody who has won two out of the first three contests and two out of the first three by very strong margins, almost 20 points in New Hampshire, solid 10 points in South Carolina. You would think that somebody like that, all else being equal, would be on track to winning the nomination. And if you look through history, you would not be wrong to think that. But Trump is, very different. Trump is somebody that I think there is very substantial resistance within the Republican Party to Trump. Certainly the party's organizational foundation, professional politicians, the people who contribute money, the people who pay close attention to politics. Those people will know, for instance, that Trump is losing even to Hillary Clinton in the polls, almost all the polls he loses to Hillary Clinton. And the people who watch the news very closely see the outrageous things that he says. This is all quite unlike any nominee in the modern era.
So he's a front runner who is not a who is very different.
Normal
rules about how a front runner who goes second in Iowa, first in New Hampshire, first in South Carolina, that front runner is going to win, you're saying may not hold because he's a different kind of front runner.
Well, he's a front runner who is attempting a hostile takeover of a political party, which has never been successfully accomplished before. That's not to say that it can't happen. It's just to say that this is a very different cycle, and we've never seen anything like this.
Well, I think all of that is true. At the end of the day, he has voters for him, and that matters a lot in the determination of who the nominee will be. And these primaries start to come very quickly now, and there isn't enough money and time to make much of an impact in the next week or so when we have a whole array of primaries and caucuses. The
12 question, of them on March 1st.
Right, so and a lot of favorable terrain for Trump. I'm not making the case that he's got the nomination sewn up, but he has some advantages, and that it, unless he himself somehow reverses the pattern of being able to avoid losses due to his own comments, if somehow that stops happening and he starts losing support, sure. But if he continues to hold at the levels he's demonstrated in these upcoming races, he probably comes out of March 1st in an even stronger position, and then it starts to become hard to prevent him from now. Obviously, it's possible he could be prevented by a coalition of everybody else from getting enough delegates, but then the party has to face the consequences of nominating somebody who doesn't have that type of popular support. That'd be a little bit hard to do.
So you think the simplest scenario sort of going forward is Trump wins a plurality of the vote in most of the states on May 1st, maybe a majority of the delegates, given how the rules work with, 20% thresholds, and if you win the CD, you get all the delegates, with 50%, you get all the delegates in some of these places, or you get 2 out of 3, and so it does tilt, I think it tilts more towards the winner, to the plurality, you could win a plurality of the votes and get a majority of the delegates, right, on March 1st, it seems to be in most of these
states.
Well,
he did in South Carolina.
And South Carolina got, I guess, all the delegates.
50 right? delegates with 32% or whatever the vote.
So the simplest scenario is Trump has a very good March 1st, and then what? And then he just keeps on winning, basically, right?
Well, that may be the case. The question really is, do one of the next tier of candidates, Cruz and Rubio, fade? Most likely, people would think that'd be Ted Cruz, because in some ways, he and Trump draw from the same alienated, disenfranchised Republican voter pool. But I'm not sure that Ted Cruz will want to go away, because he probably thinks if Donald Trump at some point hits a wall, that he's the likeliest beneficiary of that alienated Republican voter. And so if you have this multi-candidate contest, Trump seems to be in a position to roll up a fair number of delegates. But it could be a three-way split in those later states in such a way that there's a deadlock. It wouldn't shock me if that happens. Trump has managed to, say almost anything and still retain his support, which I think is the surprising thing about this race. I think that's the most difference from what we've experienced before. Usually candidates who have stumbles suffer consequences. This time around, not so much.
Especially not ones who don't have a long track record, so they're meteors, and then they, Herman Cain or whatever, then they come back down to earth. And he was the meteor who has now stayed up a long time, right?
Yeah.
7 months atop the polls. What do you think, Jay? You've done some analysis of the vote in South Carolina. Maybe it's not as good a terrain for Trump going forward. Give the Trump's understanding. These are all just
speculative
guesses and analysis,
sure.
And no one's. We're not saying one thing is by any means determined to happen, or even necessarily likely to happen. What's the scenario of Trump, absent just total blowing up? Of him just falling short, not being quite as strong as people think?
Well, first of all, I'm not entirely sure Trump is going to have as good a Super Tuesday as everybody's speculating. I think that Trump is going to win a lot of states, but Ted Cruz has Texas on Super Tuesday. And the delegate allocation rules of Texas are very interesting. It's winner take most, but there's a caveat that if you win 50% or more in a congressional district, you will win all of the delegates. So it's hard to estimate exactly where Cruz lands because there's not a lot of good polling, and certainly not a lot of good polling by congressional district. But if, Texas decides to be, I don't want to call it parochial, but, the sort of the old home state kind of, back the guy from your home state to go to the White House. Look, he's going to win a lot of delegates on Super Tuesday. And then you look ahead to March 15th.
Well, let's answer this. So your analysis of South Carolina, you wrote this up a little bit.
Sure.
That the area, I think I'll put it this way, you corrected, that the parts of South Carolina where Trump was relatively weaker in, though still pretty strong, but, didn't win outright or won by a very small margin, are more like a lot of voter-rich and delegate-rich
right.
areas that will be voting on March 1st and subsequent
right.
primaries. Is that right?
Yeah.
The less South Carolina-like parts of South Carolina
right.
are more like the Atlanta suburbs or Fairfax County in Virginia or something like that.
Exactly.
And in those areas, Trump was not as dominant.
Trump was
right?
not dominant in those areas. Trump lost Charleston to Rubio. And he lost it to Rubio even as Bush and Kasich were poaching upwards of 15 to 20 points off of Rubio. Rubio and Trump and Cruz basically split the vote in Greenville, which is sort of an up and coming place in the upcountry. So that gives me pause looking ahead to Super Tuesday. So I see Super Tuesday. I look at Texas and I think that there's a lot of places in Texas where Trump could do very well, but it's Cruz's home turf. So, you look at a state like Mississippi or a state like Alabama and I think, okay, those are going to be good Trump states. But on the other hand, you go south, like a place like Mobile, Alabama, Mitt Romney did well there in 2012. I could see, Rubio doing well while there. Similarly, the Atlanta suburbs and then Middle Tennessee. I could see, you know, Rubio had a huge rally there. And again, all of this is, you know, there's it's sort of a winner take most formula. Where everything, a lot of, not everything, but a lot of the delegates are flushed out by congressional districts. So it's really hard to project exactly what that means. And then when we move beyond that.
Let me interrupt and ask you about this. What would be, I mean, do you think in terms of expectations, momentum, to the degree that means something, donors, all that sort of, what number, what will people now expect on March 1st? What will be a Trump, you know, setback? What would be enough for Rubio and Cruz to say, you know, this is by no means over. In fact, he's kind of, you're seeing the limits of Trump versus the opposite. I mean, do you think if Trump gets an absolute majority of the delegates on March 1st, that's very strong, or even more than that, or will it be the popular vote? How should we look when we look Tuesday night at our computers? What should we be sort of
I think you'll get a mixture of analyses depending on the perspective of the analyst. You know, to me, Trump has to, you know, not win more than half the states for people to say, well, his momentum slowed. I mean, if he carries half or more of the states, it
so
would seem to
me. So late Tuesday night, you're looking at your computer and Trump has won a plurality victory in 7 or 8 of the 12 states, which probably translates, leaving aside the Texas wrinkle, into a plurality of delegates, presumably, and maybe even close to a majority, I should think. That's the continuation of Trump.
He will still be seen as the guy who's winning the primaries and the caucuses. If he's held to half or less, I think then it changes the dynamic dramatically. And I think the media would probably cover it that way. But these, you know, that would be at least a measuring stick. I think it's, you know, we can get down into how many delegates come out of it. But at the end of the day, if somebody's winning 7 or 8 out of 11, you know, it's hard to say they're not, you know, the strong
candidate. I think it has an effect on other voters, that you see the check marks go up next to a, you know, a Virginia, a Mississippi, a Tennessee, maybe a Massachusetts. I think they're on the first, maybe. And, you know, suddenly, you know, if you're a voter in a state that's going to vote on the 5th or the 8th or the 15th, you think to yourself, well, Trump seems to be doing fine. I guess I can vote for him, too. You know, I come back to that normalization and legitimization of Trump that I think increases every time he wins. Maybe I'm over doing that, Jay. You've been a bit of a skeptic on the momentum issue generally, and
there was an interesting number in the recent Fox News poll that came out this last week before South Carolina, but after the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll shocked everybody for 10 minutes showing Cruz in front of Trump. Right, the Fox News poll showed Trump up like 15 points. But, you know, if you dig deep, it was like almost on the very last page of that poll. There was a question of, do you think this, each candidate, they would ask this particular question about each candidate. Is Donald Trump a good role model for your children? 50-50 on that number. I was really struck
by
that
Republicans.
Number. Among Republicans. PPP did a national poll a couple of weeks ago that was actually among, you know, like likely voters, and found his favorable rating at about +7, which is a terrible number.
Among Republicans.
Nationwide, and this is the other thing, too.
Well, in South Carolina, I think 40% of having won, on the day he won the state, the exit poll showed that 40% of the Republicans in South Carolina they would never vote
exactly
for him, which is a very high negative for a front runner,
right.
I suppose.
The AP poll, which came out a couple days ago, showed his favorable rating among Republicans at 40%. So I think that, you know, that's something to bear in mind as we move forward. And I think that gives, if a candidate can continue, a non-Trump candidate can continue to put television ads on the air and put fuel in his jet and travel around and hold rallies, then I'm very skeptical.
Skeptical
of Trump running away with it. There was a similar sort of sentiment in the 2008 Democratic primary, whereby Obama won on Super Tuesday and everybody was like, oh, well, here we go. You know, this is it. It's over. But wouldn't you know, the very last day of the cycle, the day before Hillary Clinton declared defeat, Obama lost the South Dakota primary to Hillary Clinton by 10 points.
Yeah. Voters don't get the memo always.
No, voters don't get the memo. And moreover,
On the other hand, Obama won in 2008.
He did.
To make the obvious point.
Well, so. Yeah, that's true. But one of the differences, though, with the, and this is something to bear in mind, one of the differences is between the Democratic and the Republican delegate allocation formulas is that the Democratic system is proportional all the way down the line.
Right,
so if you're behind by 10 delegates, you're going to really struggle to catch up. And then there was, and the way it was allocated a lot of times, Hillary Clinton, for instance, beat Obama by 3 points in the Texas primary, whatever. She beat him by a small margin, but Obama took more delegates. So the Republican side, and this is where I think things get interesting, right? Is that, you know, we look at Super Tuesday and we think, oh, well, Trump's going to win all these states. Well, let's go ahead to March 15th, and if John Kasich is still in the race, I would not count him out to win the Ohio primary, which is 66 delegates, winner take all. Florida, 99 delegates, winner take all, with Jeb out and the Florida Republican Party corralling around Marco Rubio. And I could envision a scenario in which, you know, Cruz, maybe because Texas is, you know, the way Texas's delegate rules actually work, Cruz doesn't get all 155 or however many delegates, but I could see him getting a lot of delegates out of Texas, and then Rubio sweeping Florida and Kasich sweeping Ohio. And then you start then the question flips. Now it's a big if.
But so March 15th is your sort of
March 15th,
firewall for the Trump momentum.
Well, the question then becomes how does Trump
to mix that metaphor?
How does Trump get to a majority of delegates? Right.
Okay.
Well, my point earlier was that I thought Trump has probably the highest probability of the existing candidates to win the nomination, and I didn't put it at 50% because I do think the possibility exists, as Jay's just outlined, for an outcome where you have some real division here in some of these key states, and then you have probably for the Republican Party a potentially worse scenario of going to a convention with nobody in charge and nobody with a majority, and a bunch of very independent people on the floor of that convention moving in God knows what direction through what could be a multi-day affair that has the great potential to be sort of circus-like in environment. Now, maybe that's good, maybe it's not, but it won't be something we can predict very
fun
well.
Fun for us to cover, but
yeah,
maybe
of course.
Not great
yeah.
for the Republican. Well, let me come back to that, because that's very interesting, obviously, the whole contested convention. But one thing people, I think, are underestimating is, so on March 1st, one reason if people are thinking, why are we talking so much about that? I mean, there are 595 delegates out of a total of 2472. So, you know, not just a bit under a quarter of the entire delegates selected on that one day. Mm-hmm. It is really important, I think, in that respect. You know, if we look up on our TV screens and Cruz and Trump has won 400 out of 595, that's a very different reality in terms of delegates, but also a different psychology than if he's won 300 or 270 or 250. So the first is important, just the scale, assuming Trump does better than anyone else, how much better, I suppose. The other thing that people haven't focused on, then I've done this too, skip to the 15th, which is the big Florida and Ohio winner-take-all.
So
Illinois is sort of winner-take-all, right? It's some confusing. And I guess Missouri is that day too. So a lot of big states, 367 delegates that day. But between these two, on March 5th, there are 155 delegates, Kentucky, Louisiana, Kansas. And then on the 8th, so the Tuesday in between, Michigan, along with some smaller states, somewhat smaller, Mississippi and Idaho. So, you're from Michigan. So,
yeah.
But I mean, you add up all those delegates, even Puerto Rico in between on the 6th. So, there are quite a lot of delegates in that week between the 2 weeks between the 1st and the 15th. And again, that's why. And those are still under the not winner take all.
Right.
It could be, Trump could be really rolling by the 14th, or he could have hit various obstacles and it's much more competitive. I guess that really is,
we really are hitting the crucial month, right?
If
there wasn't reasons to continue, people would be dropping out. I mean, there's obviously,
before we get to the contested convention. So you're sitting in, okay, let's go through them one by one. Rubio camp. Should we go backwards or forward? Let's go backwards. Ben Carson, no real chance. Right?
Not a road forward, I don't think.
And either gets out or doesn't, but even if he doesn't get that much vote, presumably, right? I mean, so doesn't become a factor. Pushes out, so now we're down to four. Kasich, going backwards, I guess. Kasich, Cruz, Rubio. Walk through the considerations.
Well,
you've been in these campaigns.
Yeah, well, I think we can assume that there'll be a tremendous amount of a consolidation of support behind Marco Rubio from party leaders, elected officials, major donors, Bush supporters, particularly in Florida. And I don't think too much toward Kasich. I'd put those two together because they're both still fighting for sort of the similar, you know, party regular wing of the primary. And I think that Rubio will secure most of that support. And the question is, though, if the longer it's divided by two, the harder it is to get to results that Jay was outlining, where, you know, somebody can actually begin to beat Trump in some of these states. But I think Rubio has the next best path. And I think Cruz's path is sort of limited. I mean, I think he sort of has to hope that somehow Trump begins to fade. And then right. If I were Ted Cruz or his supporters, I guess I'd be trying to recast the race and suggest he's the anti-establishment candidate. Marco Rubio, with every endorsement from either an elected official or the major donors supporting Bush, Rubio becomes much more the sort of Bush understudy, the party regular candidate. And I think Cruz will try to then, should there be a fade with Trump, try to step into the role of being the person behind whom is consolidated the people who want to run against the party leadership and the establishment.
And if you're anti-Trump, should you want Cruz to stay in for a while, since he's taking voters who are probably closer to Trump voters than Rubio would if you were alone against Trump? Or do you need a consolidation, or are both somehow true and you want him to stay in for a while and then to get out at the right time? Which, I mean, does the world work that way? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I would say that you might, if you're sitting in Rubio's shoes, appreciate having more than one gun leveled at Donald Trump. And Cruz has been willing to take on Trump very vocally, very spiritedly, with paid media and other devices. And having somebody else help shoulder that responsibility isn't such a bad thing. And yes, he may be, in fact, drawing more vote, you know, that would go to Trump than to Rubio. But that's, you know, I mean, we always say those things, but you never know when there's, you know, the dynamics of these campaigns, where the vote would really go, or if it would be cast at all. But I think I might like to have somebody around for a while here, throwing a few more howitzer shells into the Trump camp.
I mean, they're both clearly in, and Kasich clearly in, I think, through the first, through next week. They're not going anywhere. What do you think happens then, Jay? Do you think, I mean, does Cruz or Rubio pretty much into the 15th, or could Cruz, if Cruz does poorly in Texas, for example, his home state, do you think conceivably he could get out?
Cruz has got to win Texas by a large margin. If he wins Texas by a large margin, then I would not underestimate his prospects to win the nomination. And I would not underestimate his capacity to recast the narrative, because we could have a scenario on Super Tuesday where Trump wins these small states by a couple points, doesn't rack up any delegates, Cruz just blows everybody away in Texas, and then that's a new day.
Yeah, it's interesting you're focusing so much on Texas. Now, do we know that? I guess we don't know how strong Cruz is in Texas against Trump. He won a good Senate race in Texas, but that doesn't prove he can beat Trump in a presidential.
Cruz has definitely, I think, got a hope for a continuing split of the delegates, for Rubio to come on and win his fair share, and to try to get into a deadlock situation. I think that's his best formula going forward. I don't think he can count on Trump to completely disappearing from the scene, where, you know, he becomes a non-factor. So I think for Cruz, a convention where Trump, Rubio, and Cruz, and perhaps some delegates for Kasich, you know, are the way the split is the one scenario where he maybe has a shot to win, because he theoretically could be more appealing to the actual bodies on the floor of that convention than any of the candidates, because of his...
After
they're released. Certainly a lot of the Trump delegates would probably be more inclined toward somebody like Ted Cruz. And so I don't think he's going away unless he, you know, was really devastated in the next couple of weeks. But if he holds into the kind of percentages he's been running in, I would think he'd stay for a while.
And how damaging, though, is that to the chances to actually defeat Trump in winner-take-all states in Florida and Ohio, if you've got Rubio and Cruz, at least nominally? I guess they could sort of de facto divide things up a little bit, or with Kasich too, they're all competing. Don't we just have South Carolina again? I mean, in these winner take all
states? Not necessarily. In Ohio, if it's a four-way race and Kasich has money and Kasich is seen as a viable choice by Ohioans, I'm gonna bet Ohioans make a play for themselves. They're going to see a vote for Kasich as a vote to put one of their own in the White House, and I think Floridians will do the same. And then you go over to Illinois, and Kasich's team is, there's a lot of overlap between Kasich's team and the Illinois Republican Party over there. I don't know what the Illinois is funny. They have like a beauty contest with delegates, and it's like when I don't know how Illinois works, but I think that it's effectively winner take most in Illinois. So I could see a situation in which a four-way race. Right now, the narrative.
So you're not on the side, and I kind of agree with you, but I think we're in a minority in this, of the, to stop Trump, you got to get everyone out of the race. It's got to clarify as fast as possible.
I'm less confident of that because I think a couple things. First of all, we haven't had any contests in the Midwest. Right. You have a guy like Kasich who sounds like he's from the Midwest, who looks like he's from the Midwest, who talks like he's from the Midwest. I mean, the guy could not be more Midwestern. And the Republican Party doesn't nominate people from the Midwest, and I don't know what the Midwestern Republican Party is going to do.
Yeah, Spence, what are you getting on top of that?
I have my doubts about, people have been, saying, for the sake of stopping Trump, Kasich has to drop out. I'm not convinced of that. I think that I want to see what happens in Michigan, what Kasich can do in Michigan.
What do you think about Michigan? Spence's state.
Yeah. There were two polls that came out last week. One had Trump at 45 and one had him at 25. So who's to say at this point? It's a very much, that was before South Carolina's voting, but he was leading in both polls, and the other candidates were pretty much in the same numbers in both polls, except Trump was 20 points higher in one than in the other. I assume he's leading there. For Kasich, I would just say this. He faces the challenge that Rick Santorum faced in 2012 of having the potential to lose his home state and potentially even finish not even second, but perhaps fourth in that state.
Well, then he's gone.
I think that Kasich's determination of whether to continue his candidacy will turn on his own state and his potential to avoid embarrassment there.
So you think he could get out before the 15th if he gets nothing on March 1st?
That's what I think will happen.
And then I guess we wait for Michigan?
He might wait for Michigan.
But if he loses that by 20 points to Trump.
But I predict they'll be doing some serious tracking in Ohio. And if today the primary were there, I think he'd win it. But if the events of March 1st and maybe Michigan a week later were to severely damage him and risk the potential of not being able to win his own state or even finish strongly. Then I think he might well pull out and try to influence the primary in Ohio by endorsing somebody else. That's kind of what I suspect would take place.
So Michigan on the 8th is important.
Michigan is very important. Yeah. It's a good test case for
Illinois Kasich. And Ohio, presumably, and for Kasich. Yeah. And maybe also for whether Trump has support, which we don't quite know yet, I suppose, in the Midwest. I don't know why he would or wouldn't more than in the South or New Hampshire, but still it's a different region.
Kasich's immediate problem, too, is that he doesn't have anywhere to go on Super Tuesday, except Vermont.
Yeah.
Massachusetts is not going to be a good state for him. That's going to be a good state for Trump.
Yeah, Trump had some huge number, I saw.
The caveat with that poll is that they had a number. It's basically the same as his number from October. But in all likelihood, Massachusetts is a tough state for Trump for Kasich. New England in general is like this, and we see this periodically. We think, New England's Democrat, it's liberal. But when you actually look really closely at New Englanders, they're quirky. They sort of see themselves as independent in a lot of respects. You have a very high number of self-identified independents, even in a state like Massachusetts. Less so in Rhode Island, but more so in places like New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts.
Yeah,
and
look, the best state is that New Hampshire went so well strongly for Trump, so why is... Massachusetts is most like is probably New Hampshire.
Exactly.
Right?
You look at a guy like Governor LePage in Maine, and you think, I get it.
That's
Trump, and that's a problem for Kasich because Kasich was running a rerun of the Huntsman 2012 campaign, which got him about 17% in New Hampshire because you have that old bastion of liberal Republicanism, Rockefeller Republicanism. But then you have this flinty kind of hard scrabble independent streak in those states, and if that's going to get Trump 40%, and Kasich looks like a big loser. You know, like I could see Kasich winning Vermont and losing Massachusetts, and that just in its way is kind of sad.
You do wonder about it. I just think history suggests that there are occasional reversals. Voters bring a candidate up from the dead late. This happened in Carter and some of the Clinton race in 92. But they never, those candidates never win the nomination. They're just more like protest or last minute, second.
Buyer's remorse candidates.
But Kasich is a sitting governor. He doesn't want to be that person to win. You do wonder if Kasich gets, you know, 20, I'm making this up obviously, but let's say most of Vermont and a couple other random delegates in some states, or even 30 or 40 out of 595 on March 1st.
It's a tough argument.
I mean, how viable,
it's
you know,
to carry on.
At that point, doesn't everyone in Michigan look up and say, well, this guy's not going to.
And also, Michigan.
People don't like
big,
voting for someone who's,
you know,
not.
How's he going to run? It's one thing to do 100 town halls in Michigan, which Kasich reminded people he
in
did
New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. And another thing, you go into a state like Michigan.
Yeah,
That's a big media state. You need money to get in touch.
So what about Cruz and Rubio? So they're the other. I mean, Cruz, we've discussed some. He has.
Yeah, I think his best play at this point is probably to a setting where nobody has a real majority.
Unless Trump blows up.
And Rubio's, I do think Rubio is probably leading the behind the scenes effort today to convince John Kasich that he isn't going to do well in these states, and sooner he's out, the stronger the party regular lane becomes. And if that happens, there's a way that you can add the numbers of Bush and Kasich and Rubio together and come up to 40. If you add the Trump, Carson, and Cruz numbers together, you typically get 60 in most of these states.
Cruz
stays in and Rubio consolidates and can get to the high 30s, suddenly he becomes the guy that... he's better positioned probably if Cruz stays in and if Kasich gets out than to maybe start winning some of the later contests. The question
really,
is
to get to the later contests, it sounds like he really needs to win maybe both of the winner-take-all, Florida and Ohio, or certainly at least Florida, obviously,
sure.
On the 15th. But 15th becomes a pretty huge day for Rubio.
It's a big day for Marco Rubio.
Illinois,
too. He needs to do well in the Chicago suburbs. Those are the people he needs.
Yeah.
And he needs to hold off the downstaters against Trump in a state like Illinois.
Yeah. And he needs to win Florida, which incidentally Trump polls well in and lives half time in and has
plays golf in,
has a lot of connections there presumably. So the So this is an important. So what is it now? February 20th. So really, by a month from now, by March 20th. I mean, we then have a weird spring break where there are not many states that vote and not many delegates selected. All the way from the 15th of March, really to the 19th of April, when New York votes. There are some states in there, Wisconsin in particular, but not much actually. So each Tuesday, there's like one state that votes. So it is sort of, you can see that. I mean, the survival through the 15th. I don't quite know what the effect of, you've been through this a couple of times, what is the effect of a lull like that? I mean, does it help the front runner consolidate? Does it let people get recharged their batteries if they're second or third?
It depends. It probably, at this point, I would say, gives Rubio a chance to raise money. If he's, assuming he comes out of this period we've just discussed as a viable candidate, it's a time where they can try to rebuild the war chest so that they can go full tilt at fairly high levels of spending in some of these key final states, Pennsylvania, New York, California, some of these bigger media market states.
Yeah, New Jersey.
And so I think that's kind of how his campaign would use that time.
So Rubio would need to be able to say on March 16th, look, Trump's got, I'm making this up obviously, 42% of the delegates so far, but I've got 29, and Cruz, whatever, he'll do his thing. He's got 17, but Kasich's got a few. But A, Kasich's out now, and B, I can catch him. If I now can really run a strong campaign in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, California, I'll show you the math. I can catch and beat Donald Trump at the convention. That would have to be the Rubio pitch,
right. Yeah, I think he has to be able to show that there's enough. He's doing well enough, and will continue to do well enough that if he prevails in those later states, he can get to the nomination or at least stop Trump. I mean, at this point, there may be a point when Trump has enough delegates and is likely to garner enough remaining delegates to be the guy with the most votes. But then the scene shifts to can we stop Trump and nominate somebody more electable. And I think that becomes, you know, unless Rubio runs the table through, you know, some new burst of momentum, which could happen, I suppose, but unless that happens, I think then the campaign becomes both Cruz and Rubio hoping to stop Trump and try to argue that Rubio, that he's the electable alternative to Trump, and Cruz, that he's the real conservative anti-establishment alternative to Trump, and see where they can go. But Trump will have a lot to say about how those definitions are played out.
And Jay, just to come back to the Trump, so it comes back to Trump and how much he can sustain that strength, and we've all been wrong. I've certainly been wrong in thinking with each statement or each, you know, hiccup in a way, that he would start to lose altitude in Iowa. I mean, I said, and I don't think this was, didn't seem ridiculous at the time, it turned out to be wrong, that, you know, the Trump momentum depends so much on this sort of sense of almost invulnerability and inevitability and almost like his mystical ability to do well in the polls. And once he, if he were to lose a caucus or a primary, some of that would vanish. So he promptly lost Iowa. Cruz did an excellent job with his ground game and pulled it out by, what, 4 or 5 points. And Trump promptly comes back and wins New Hampshire by 20. It didn't hurt him at all, so far as one can tell, in New Hampshire or South Carolina. That, for me, is the most sort of the moment where I thought, oh, my God, it's not just that he's riding a wave here, but he seems to have real staying power. Because that would have been, I don't think, my analysis, I think, could have been right if he were a different type of candidate. And he turned out not to be, do you?
I mean, I think in primaries, I would distinguish caucuses here, because I do think in caucuses, Trump may continue to see him, his performance or himself underperform. But in these primaries, up till now, whatever vote whatever vote he's got, he's bringing them out to the polls. They're showing up. I don't think, at least in the short term, that's going to change.
Oh, it's still only 35 and 32 percent in New Hampshire and South Carolina. He hasn't proven, so to speak, that he can get 48 or 55. I mean, that's
after
a question.
New Hampshire, his margin over Rubio in South Carolina was more than 20 points. He finished 10 points, and that was in a week, a little over a week.
I'm just going to comment. I think Trump is, in effect, the equivalent of an incumbent right now in terms of his polling. I mean, he's universally known. The support he has is the support you would have for the incumbent in most races. And these other candidates are all really in those final weeks of these primaries.
Surging.
They're surging because they're finally running full blast TV. They're campaigning very visibly and getting their own news coverage finally. So it's not it seems to me inevitable that Trump's going to come down a little bit. He's not going to gain ground. He's going to lose a little bit as there are others that get exposure. But the fact that he still wins by big margins to me is
the good news is his margin went from 20 to 10 an anti-Trump point of view. But the bad news is guy went from 35 or 6 to 32, which is not much of a loss.
Yeah, and remember, given the things that happened to support Marco Rubio in the final week, I mean,
Nikki
he had
Haley,
a lot of
you
the
incumbent
Nikki Haley and
governor
and,
supporting
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the
one
very
of the two
popular
very popular senator Tim Scott
and Gowdy and others.
The
I mean, he really had a lot going for him. And I mean, there's two ways to look at his number, and one of them is to say, wow, he came up to finish second, and the other is to say, and after with all of those things happening and more or less no campaign from Kasich and a complete collapse in the Bush campaign at the end, he still only got to 22. That's not if you're looking at the other side, and I'm not trying to be pessimistic toward Ruby, I'm just saying there's a way to look at the outcome and say Trump did pretty well.
I mean, I guess, do you agree, Jay, that, I mean, looking at Northern Virginia and Virginia as a whole, I should think, on March 1st, in Georgia maybe, and especially the Atlanta suburbs,
Georgia,
I mean, that would be
Chattanooga,
places that Rubio should presumably do well and be able to pick up real delegates and real margins, have real margins.
Minnesota
over Trump.
Has a caucus, which is not great for Trump.
But if Trump can win places like the Atlanta suburbs, then he's off to the races.
Well, look, if Trump is like an incumbent, because that sort of idea is in conflict with this idea of Trump building momentum. I mean, this is the question, right? This is the question, which is that is Trump where he's going to be,
right,
or can he grow? Because he hasn't grown. He didn't grow. He had everything break his way in New Hampshire. The guy who was up and coming, especially after, you go into New Hampshire, and Cruz immediately pulls his punch. Cruz pulls his punches on Trump.
Calculating, Rubio is searching.
Yeah, calculating as Cruz ever does, ever calculating, that helping Trump in New Hampshire would just help some, or hurting Trump would just help somebody other than himself. So you remember Cruz made that comment right out of Iowa, saying something to the effect of, you know, Trump will start a nuclear war with Belgium. Mm-hmm. And then he was asked about that at the debate, and he could have said in front of tens of millions of people, yeah, we should all be worried about this guy. And he didn't say anything. He kept his mouth shut. And in the very same debate, Rubio has that meltdown with Christie. Everything breaks his way. He comes out of New Hampshire. He's at 38% or thereabouts in the polls, and he finishes. He loses 5 points in a week from where he was in the polls. So if he is like... if he is like an incumbent where he is, his level is locked in, then really the nature of the challenge to stop Trump shifts. And it becomes less of an issue of worrying about actually how many delegates he pulls and how many states flash, you know, gold on the big board on Super Tuesday. And it becomes more of a question of, well, who's going to get knocked out next? Because if he's an incumbent who's locked at 33%, then I see him losing in a two-way race, and that's what we need to get to. And then the question then becomes, when do we get to a two-way race? So there's two different theories here. And if you read people online, and nobody knows the answer. Nobody knows yet. Nobody knows.
I guess there is polling that shows him losing nationally a two-way race to Cruz and Rubio. It's just hard to know what to make of that, I guess.
Yeah, and if you're Cruz and Rubio, and you've seen that data, you have no incentive to leave the race,
right?
Because sooner or later that could be your opportunity. We can look at it a lot of different ways, but you know, there's got to be a night when these, you know, primary headquarters are not yelling, we're number three, we're number three,
right?
Or we're number two. Unless they're yelling, we're number one, they're not going to get there. And there's a point when, you know, if Trump continues to prevail, even, he didn't get as many delegates as he, you know, would have liked or whatever, but you keep winning these primaries, and it the case for the other candidates starts to erode as well.
Yeah, I think the primaries are more important than caucuses. I've always thought that the voters have a certain sense that a primary kind of counts more, plus the numbers are bigger when you see it on the screen,
yeah,
in terms of the vote. And if Trump wins, Trump has won the first two primaries. They're 10 of the 12 on March 1st is our primaries. I do kind of agree. If you just see checkmark after checkmark next to Trump in the big-ish primary states, the Virginias, the Tennessees, the Georgias, the Alabamas, you can say it's only the South. It's not quite representative. But, it would be extremely unusual for someone to win 8 or 9 of the first 10 primaries and not be the nominee. I mean, I guess that really is.
Yeah, but on the other hand, though, Trump is running an extremely unusual campaign.
Yes, it's an unusual, and he's not like other front runners.
I think that something needs,
it's good that Jay is keeping hope alive. Something
that needs to be priced in here, right, is, you know, we were talking a moment ago about how Trump collapsed or had an opportunity handed to him between New Hampshire and South Carolina. And, you know, yes, he won South Carolina. He was set to win South Carolina by upwards of 25 points. And
I don't think he was ever going to win.
The point, though,
is that what happened in between the New Hampshire and the South Carolina primary? You know, he said that George W. Bush lied about having weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or knowing that there were no weapons. And one of the characteristics that I think is notable about Trump is that he is not making any effort to broaden his appeal. I haven't seen anything like that. And he's not doing all sorts of things that we take for granted that candidates are supposed to do. He doesn't have policy advisors, really. He doesn't have a policy team.
For me, I take it the opposite way, which is he said what I would have thought would be the most damaging thing you could say in a state like South Carolina, accusing the previous Republican president, who incidentally won that state in a big way in his campaign in 2000 and who was popular in that state, of lying us into war. And it knocks a couple of points off. I mean, that makes me wonder.
I don't think he lost any significant margin from what he would have had. I mean, you know, all these other guys were relatively new faces in that state, except for Bush. And I think there was a certain number of people that were waiting to figure out, to get some clarification of where sort of the party leadership and the mainstream was going. And as that clarification happened, they moved to Rubio, which helped him. And the small decrease for Trump, you know, some polls 38, some 36, whatever. But, you know, he ended up at 33 with all of this happening to him. And that's pretty formidable.
Right.
I'm not trying to say that I'm not a Trump supporter. I don't read too much into the final results there, other than that Trump got 50 out of 50 delegates and won by, you know, double digits.
I mean, I guess Jay's point would be, yeah, if he, at some point, if he keeps getting 33 or even 35 or 6 like he got in New Hampshire, it's not enough. And so, and does he have there is some polling data and other evidence that he has a less capacity to grow than the other candidates.
I think that's
well,
true.
Look, I think that, you know.
But it has to manifest itself somewhere.
That's, you know, if we're judging him by historical making a historical comparison, you know, nominees tend to be a consensus choice of a party. Not necessarily everybody's first choice, but they by and large tend to be somebody that everybody can live with.
Well, except when they're not, when it's Goldwater or McGovern.
In those circumstances, what you have is a knockdown, drag-out fight that drags on and on and on and on. And I think and one of the unique things about this, right, whereas you look, for instance, at 84 in the Democratic Party, you know, Mondale versus Hart, they split that party in two. And Obama and Clinton in 2008, once again, they split that party in two. You know, if we were on a glide path toward Trump splitting the party into two pieces, then I would be more, you know, bullish on Trump and bearish on America. But that is sort of my, sort of what I keep coming back to, is that he keeps doing these things that, you know, yes, it's not hurting him with his core base of support, which is, you know, so far 32, 33. But you get this rising sense of just this growing number of people who are appalled by him. Now, whether or not they amount to a majority or not, whether or not they end up capitulating, my point is simply that this is not how people historically win nominations. They win nominations by appealing to some core group, which Trump most certainly has, but then they take conscientious efforts to broaden their appeal and to expand their base. And a great example of that, by the way.
We don't know that he's not going to do that. We're only three states in. Well, so this morning we have Rudy Giuliani talking to him, and he's calling Bill Bennett to get advice on education policy. I'm a little worried that he could do a little more.
Well, yeah, but then he puts out a tweet this morning, you know, taking, you know, basically threatening the owner of the Chicago Cubs. I mean, you know, this is not something that somebody who, you know, is looking to win a broad swath of the party does. You know,
but he also, I think, you know, looks at the field and says, well, if at some point Cruz starts to fade, there's a lot of people for Ted Cruz who hate the establishment, want something new, want a dramatic change, hate Mitch McConnell, whatever. And as they look at the remaining candidates, they will see a Marco Rubio who has become the stand-in for all of those people and me. And I'm going to get some of those. That's going to expand my base. And if somehow Marco Rubio fades, well, you know, I'm going to do better in Florida because Marco Rubio is my major threat there. And I'm going to do better in some of these other states where, you know, Trump did pretty well among self-described moderates in the exit polling in South Carolina. So it isn't like they're all going to race to Ted Cruz at that point. They actually might prefer him. So if he's watching us, he sees what conventional wisdom is, and he seems to be, you know, committed to doing what's not conventional. But instead of trying to expand his base right now, I think he sees himself in a very enviable position. He's got two detractors, and maybe Kasich is a little ways behind, who are going to keep going at each other to try to become the legitimate alternative, and he's got the ability to potentially appeal to some of the supporters of each of them. So I think he's going to be content to let them, you know, take on each other a little
bit. But I think Jay's point would be at some point he'll have to be able to pivot a little bit and do better. And I guess we'll see how he does on March 1st and then especially in
Michigan. Yeah, and my only point is that there are people in each of the Cruz and Rubio support groups who he can appeal to when their candidacies start to fade. I think it's pretty clear with each of them how he would attempt to
but
do
for
that.
For now, I suppose, with both of them in the race, he can be content to rev up his support, get it into the high 30s if possible in these key states on the 1st and then on the 15th, and just win them. I mean, that would be what he'll try
and
to do.
And let Rubio and Cruz fight each other out.
You know? I think about the way Trump is running his campaign, and I juxtapose that with how he must certainly have run his casino businesses, right? Where, you know, thinking about building a new casino, you know, you don't just wing it. You know, you do your diligence. You mimic best practices. You take the foundation of what other people do, and then you innovate on top of it, right? So when we talk, for instance, about, you know, oh, well, Trump will try and peel these people off here and here and here. Well, you know, you have to know who those people are. You have to know where they live. You have to focus group them. You have to poll them. You have to develop issue positions and angles of attack. And I mean, it was extraordinary.
Well, you don't have to. I mean, you can if you wish.
That's true. You can wing it. And, you know, so when it comes to
He's extremely shrewd, though. I think you're being too...
I think he probably, in his casino business, said, if I can get 33% of the market share in a new market by just building a casino...
And branding it in some garish way and advertising...
That's not a bad deal.
I've been sort of struck by how much he adapts, Jay, though. I think he's very shrewd that way. He'll test something. If it works, he'll double down on it. If it doesn't work, it sort of goes away in a few days, you know, and he kind of quietly retracts. He's not going to repeat the Bush led us into war. And in effect, he's refused to. He never apologizes. He never, you know, so it's a weird way.
Sarah Palin,
it's not the way we're used to candidates doing it. Right. Yeah. So Palin's not going to be that prominent now, probably.
Right. Right?
But he does test, you know, the Muslim thing, and then that worked well. And everyone, so just that, he's doubling down on it. It strikes me as a kind of, it's not the style we're used to, but it's not exactly unempirical. He's quite empirical and testing lines and then doubling down on them or pulling them back. Or you think he really is just winging it?
I do. Well, look, that debate that he had in South Carolina, there was no reason under heaven and earth for him to get in a fight with Jeb Bush. And the fact that he did that and the
fact disagree
that
he totally.
Going, I disagree too.
Bush is his. He wouldn't exist if it weren't for Jeb Bush.
And
Bush
the Saturday
the, and he
night,
understands that him
Saturday
fighting
night,
Bush is the best thing he can do.
Saturday night before George W. Bush was coming into campaign, which was garnering all the headlines at that point in South Carolina. And I think Trump, whether he's wise or not wise to do it, wanted to, you know, in fact, create a firestorm around and questions about the presidency of George W. Bush. And while we might not think it was an appropriate attack, I certainly don't, I think it did kind of shift the discussion about Bush a little bit away from what it would have been otherwise, which was, you know, President Bush is here for his brother, isn't this a great story, et cetera, to, you know, was Trump right or wrong to make these criticisms? I mean, it was. I think it was calculated. And I honestly, Jay, I don't agree about how Trump will go after these votes. I think Trump looks at Rubio and Cruz and sees within each of them a portion of their support that he would get if they faded. In the case of Cruz, he will then portray the race as the outsiders versus the establishment. And a lot of that Cruz vote is anti-establishment Republicans.
Cruz goes away, you're saying.
Cruz goes away. And if Rubio were to not connect and it was Trump and Cruz, he would try to portray, you know, Cruz as a far right zealot extremist, farther, you know, out on issues that his coalition, Trump's coalition, agrees with Trump on, and I think he will do that. I mean, does it mean he gets to 50 versus 48? I don't know, but I think it's not. I don't think he needs a lot of focus grouping. I think he'll know how to do it. So I think he's got a strategy. I'm not a Trump supporter, but I see where he's analysis.
No, well, I guess we'll close on the Republicans with this. I mean, I suppose one way to test this a little bit is to see on March 1st. I mean, he's gotten 35 in New Hampshire and 32.5 in South Carolina. So that's a pretty easy mark to sort of keep in one's mind. If he's getting consistently above a third of the vote, I would say, in a lot of these states on March 1st, that's pretty impressive. It would show that he's not dropping and, if anything, increasing. Now, there's a slightly smaller field, but if he's dropping in a smaller field, that would suggest more what you're, I think, thinking might happen, Jay, which is that, you know, he pays a price ultimately for shooting off his mouth, and the socioeconomic characteristics of some of these states isn't quite as good for him as South Carolina. And suddenly, if we look up and he's at 28 in Virginia and 20, you know, 31 in Georgia, and, you know, I guess that's what we should look for, right, on March 1st.
Well, look, we just have to wait and see what happens. I mean, at this point, it's just a question of inputs versus outputs. You know, his inputs have been very peculiar. And we'll see ultimately. And I think, like I said, I think it remains, I don't think there's any answers to these questions. I think they are genuine because, again, nobody has ever tried to win a presidential party's nomination the way, not just right. the profile, but the way that he is doing it. We are in completely uncharted waters.
No, I think that's
there is no, I mean, you can go back to the beginning of the presidential nomination system, and you don't see anybody. If he wins the nomination, there will never have been anybody who did it the way that he will have done it. So who knows?
Okay, we're in uncharted waters. I think we can agree on that. We don't quite know what's going to happen. We have some guesses and different paths, but how did we get here? I'm interested in asking you both. You both thought about this, written about this, spoken about it. I mean, both from a tactical level and then at a sort of deeper, if you want, socioeconomic level. Sort of what happened to get us to this pretty amazing point. A year ago, I think I looked this up in the Real Clear Politics averages, Cruz and Rubio were, I think, 6th and 7th, kind of tied at about 5%. Trump wasn't polled because no one serious thought he was really going to run. He keeps threatening to run, kept threatening to run and didn't. And the first, you know, was Bush, Walker, Rand Paul, Huckabee, Christie. I think that was the top five. We've never had a race where, you know, there's such a disconnect between the early, you know, pre-primary, you know, year early polls and now what's really happening. So what, I mean, some of what happened was deep and some of what happened was just accidental, contingent, good candidates, bad candidates and stuff. So
the Republican Party is in uncharted waters in large sense because we started this race for the first time, you know, I think probably since about the 1940 nomination, without there being a clear person whose turn it was. A sitting vice president, a sitting president, the guy who lost last time, who had a lot of support within the party and was the heir apparent. And everybody noted this, but I think we've underestimated how relevant that was to the outcome.
Sort of thought Jeb Bush might fill that role.
He might, but it turned out he didn't. Certainly Romney, you know, had he gotten in, would have. But there was a vacuum that Republicans were unused to. And it kind of, I think you've got to start with that. The other thing that I think that might be linked to is that why did that matter before? I think it may now turn out that personality is a much higher driver of Republican primary support than we thought it was. I think that we've always sort of thought that, you know, other factors, you know, electability or ideological purity or whatever, and those may still be. Pragmatism and purity may be important, but personality, the third of those P's, I think may be the most important. And I think the Trump vote is in at least part because he's the big personality. And I think in the wake of the Obama presidency, you had a lot of Republicans who more than anything wanted a candidate who they thought would be strong, who would stand up to foreign adversaries, who would stand up to people they believed were undermining America either economically or taking advantage of our immigration laws or whatever. And Trump filled that vacuum. And so even though there isn't somebody whose turn it is, Trump managed, I think, very quickly to you know, sort of occupy a lot of that space. But I think that was the starting point. And, you know, there have been little things since then that have eroded support for people that might have been stronger candidates. I think there was a lot of conservative media attention aimed negatively at Jeb Bush. Maybe it was deserved, maybe it wasn't deserved, but he was probably the person who had the best chance, as you implied, of occupying some of that space. And from a very early point, the conservative media and Donald Trump damaged his candidacy, reduced him. We had Scott Walker drop out, somebody who might have been the right niche in terms of acceptability to outsiders and party regulars. You had, as you'll recall, before Iowa, some Republican establishment figures implied that Trump was better than Cruz in terms of being somebody you could make a deal with, and that hurt Cruz and certainly helped Trump. So I had a lot of things, but I think the biggest factor was the absence of the normal kind of Republican front runner environment that has typified races for a long time, for decades. And we didn't have that this cycle, and I think Donald Trump seized on that to bring support to himself.
That's interesting. Any particular one or two things that strike you, Jay?
Yeah. I mean, to dovetail off of this idea of no dominant front runner, you know, I'm a big fan of looking at the rules of the game. I think that the rules of the current nomination system work very well for like one or two candidates who are really dominant, and then a couple niche candidates, and then maybe one or two long shots, right? That's when these rules work very well. Now, historically speaking, before the modern system of primaries and open caucuses, before that, which is all relatively new, 1972, for all intents and purposes, 1976 was the first time for the Republicans. So we're only talking 40 years now, which is a very short time in the history of the Republican Party. Before that, we had the old convention style, where the people who would actually be the participants in the convention selection process were actually representatives of the state and local parties and allies of politicians and the politicians themselves. That is a very good venue for dealing with the situation we have now, which is where there is no obvious front runner. At one point we had a dozen serious candidates that you could look at and say, yeah, I could see him as president of the United States, not just a nominee, but I could see him as president. The old convention style where everybody gets in a room and they stay there until, you know, all day, and they vote, and then they vote again, and they vote again, and if there's no selection that day, they come back the next day. That's a very good system for having so many hats tossed into the ring. This system is very bad for that. We get a situation where, you know, what we have now is a collective action dilemma, where we have Cruz and Rubio. If they were to come out tomorrow and say, for the good of the country, for the good of the conservative movement, we are forming a united front against Donald Trump. I will be vice president. He will be president. But that, of course, is a problem. Is that nobody wants the vice presidency because it's, you know, as Gardner said, it's not worth a warm bucket of you know what. So the challenge though is that the old system had ways of dealing with that collective action dilemma very aggressively. That prisoner's dilemma got itself worked out over the course of a long weekend. And this system is one where you have, basically it takes, you know, if we count the pre-primary process, it takes upwards of 18 months to work its way out, and then who knows what's going to happen. And I think that that's one of the real defining points. And then the other thing I would add on top of that, vis-a-vis the front runner and Jeb Bush is that usually what happens is the smart money, the money is smart. The people with money are smart. And they look at the broad scope of candidates and they say, okay, well, of all of the potential candidates who are interested in this, this person is the best. And they tend to coalesce around that person. They did that with Romney in 2012. They did it with George W. Bush in 2000. It doesn't always work out like that. They did it with Romney in 2008 and it ended up being John McCain, although McCain had other assets. And I think that this time the money was not as smart. I think we're witnessing in real time this communication breakdown between the top tier of the party and the rest of the party. You know, when Jeb Bush threw his hat into the ring, I thought that it wasn't going to work. I didn't think it was going to work. You look at the Tea Party wave in 2010, you look at the sort of Tea Party 2.0 wave in 2014, you look at Jeb's comments on Common Core and immigration and, you know, the sorts of things that he would say, and then he would say things about raising enough money to shock and awe, or his people would, and I just thought, this is not going to work. Now, I don't begrudge Jeb Bush for getting into the race, but what I was really struck by was the rush of money to Jeb without appreciating fully pricing in the level of resistance that I intuited in the grassroots, that people were not going to bite on a fourth Bush term, right? I think that in retrospect was a miscalculation. And I think it speaks to this broader miscalculation that I think is going on. I think that there is a real legitimate disconnect between the Republican Party in Washington, D.C. and New York City and the Republican Party nationwide. And you see it, for instance, on the all the time now, on just last summer on the Iran vote. You know, the grassroots of the Republican Party was convinced that the D.C. Republicans were engaged in what a lot of bloggers were calling failure theater. Now, they were wrong on the merits of that. They didn't understand exactly how bound the Senate was in important respects. But you'll put that particular thing aside and appreciate that that was the category they instantly
took. Well,
there's
never been this kind of distrust. I think Spence was making this point before, too. I think a significant chunk of the Republican primary electorate dislikes the Republican leadership to a degree that's a little unusual.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of candidates running on the "I hate the Republican Party more than these other guys" platform.
Right.
And, I truly think there are a lot of Republican primary voters who would be accept as an acceptable outcome of 2016 Hillary Clinton's election, so long as it meant Mitch McConnell was no longer the Senate leader, they've been persuaded that somehow he's the problem. And
whether that's a genuine disconnect between sort of elites and voters and donors and voters, or is some of it ginned up just by media?
I think it's ginned up by, you know, our commentariat on the Republican side, who, you know, have spent 90% of their efforts critiquing the Republicans who are in positions of government. And surely some of the critiques that have happened were deserved, but not at the excessive amount that we've seen. And I think what's been allowed to happen here is that Hillary Clinton, and certainly Bernie Sanders, but a Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have really escaped a lot of this criticism. And I think that's unfortunate. I think that for the part in an election year, it's fine in a non-election year, but now we're in election time, and I think that people who are, you know, conservative commentators need to focus on the real opposition. And the opposition isn't the intra-party battle for political leadership positions in legislative chambers. It's for the future of the country.
There is a little Obama derangement syndrome, I think, too. And I'm the first person to say I think he's been a horrible president. But I mean, I did a radio show this morning and said, "Well, Mr. Kristol, you guys in Washington, you gave us McCain and you gave us Romney and they lost. And now finally we're taking things into our own hands." And, you know, it's like, who has time to explain that? Well, look, you know what? Republicans are probably going to lose in 2008 after Iraq being difficult, and especially after the financial meltdown. Whether it was McCain or not, I have no, you know, it's not clear that anyone would have done any better. And in 2012, I wasn't particularly a fan of Romney, but again, an incumbent president with a bit of an economic rebound, it ended up being about where the political scientists said it would be with Obama at around 50-51%. But I think the combination of the frustration of watching Obama lead the country aggressively in the wrong direction, the frustration of winning the House in 2010 and then winning the Senate in 2014 and not seeming to have much to show for it, has led, again, rightly or wrongly, but just analytically, to a greater degree of frustration with party leadership than we've seen in an awful, awful long time. And that certainly creates the grounds for a Trump.
Conversely,
it destroys a Bush, damages a Walker, Rick Perry, anyone who's more of like a normal guy who's been a governor, but normal by Republican historical standards, you know, a governor, a senator, you know. Don't you think? I mean, it really
is. I think that's what's happened, but I think there's some responsibility among those who would criticize the Republicans in Washington to channel some of the unhappiness toward winning the presidency instead of taking the position that the real enemies are ourselves and we have to, you know, essentially have a circular firing squad, outcome. And I think, but that isn't what's happening. I realize that. I'm just saying it's unfortunate because so much of the firepower in the last few months has been directed at other Republicans, by Republicans and conservative commentators, instead of at the Democrats. And hopefully as we move forward, that'll change. But if we have a protracted nomination fight, it might be very late.
I have two thoughts. They're related. The first is that the Republicans, I think a lot of people, and not without reason, were very frustrated by Ted Cruz's antics. The filibuster and threatening to shut down over Obamacare and earn him a lot of enemies in Washington, D.C. Cruz's antics are in odd-numbered years. In even-numbered years, if you listen to the rhetoric that comes out of Republican political campaigns, we're done compromising. We're going to take it to the president. We are going to fight him on the beaches. We're going to fight him in the air. We're going to fight him in the streets. We're going to fight him and fight him and fight him. And they contribute to that, because this gets to sort of the related point, right, is that the Republican Party is now, for better and for worse, the party of Congress, especially the party of the House of Representatives. It's an under-commented upon fact in our political sort of discourse. You know, we talk about this sort of the Democrats rising on the presidential level. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But, you know, the Republicans have held the House in 16 out of the last 20 years. That is a very long run. And they've inherited all of the problems inherent in Congress. Because over the last almost 100 years now, Congress has systematically divested itself of the vast authority that it was granted under the Constitution. And so Republicans get into Congress, and hey, there's not a lot we can do. But they promise a lot to get in. And I think that by Republicans, when they charged into Congress in 1994, I think that especially in the Contract with America, there were a lot of, you know, a lot of that was pointed towards advancing a conservative agenda, but a lot of it was pointed towards reforming a Congress that everybody in the minority of the Republican Party thought had been broken. And have they fixed it? I don't think they have. I think Congress remains a very problematic institution, and I think that the fact that the Republicans are now identified with Congress, I think, has done enormous damage to their reputation, at least with their own grassroots. So when people, there's this tendency in political discourse to personalize things and to think that, oh, well, you know, Mitch McConnell, he's the problem. I disagree with that. I think Mitch McConnell is fine. I think the problem is that the rules of Congress and the impotence of Congress and the fact that the Republican Party is now perceived to be the party of Congress is created enormous downstream effects within the conservative movement, and has created this sort of broad sense of distrust. Distrust is a very dangerous thing, too, because it lends itself to anarchy, in this case, Donald J. Trump.
So let's conclude by talking about Donald J. Trump a little, because we're probably treating him too much as the product of all these forces and not giving him credit. I mean, plenty of people could have tried to be the clever demagogue who takes advantage of a system that Jay doesn't like, that doesn't seem to work for this thing, or the phenomenon of not having a natural heir, or the distrust of the leadership. But Trump really has been somewhat uncanny, I guess, in the way he's played this, it seems to me, so far. Now it's been normalized, and we all take it for granted. But none of us predicted it, and we've been around a bit, so presumably if it was easy to predict, we might have predicted it. And what about Trump himself? I mean, are you struck by anything in particular?
Well, I would start with the discussion this way. We all sort of have, I think, in our minds a sense of how presidential candidates are supposed to behave, right. And what they are what's expected of them. And I would call it the Marquis de Queensberry rules of politics. And all the other candidates, in one way or another, abide by the Marquis de Queensberry political rules, except Trump. And Trump, maybe because of what he's done in his life and in his reality television show career and in his observations of the American public, seemed to understand that those rules were no longer necessary in a political campaign, or that they could be effectively ignored. And he's done that. I mean, he said things that would normally have, generated, as many of his did, broad admonishment from the media and from the other candidates and so on. But he recognized that there was a group of voters who don't consider his comments to be inappropriate or sick of political correctness, right. and also who. We live in a world where people yell at each other on television and say kind of outlandish things, and they're popular. They're popular because they're either seen as telling it like it is, or they're popular because people like to see, this kind of, outspokenness, right. Whatever it might be. But that's what I think, more than most things, has accounts for the fact that he gets away with it. This is a business he's, in his own way, been quite part of. I mean, these debates, how are they not like a reality television show? And who on that stage has anything close to the experience that he does in that type of setting? And so I think that's a big part of it. And I do think the rules are different. And I think the other candidates are still in the old rules of engagement world. And I think he's in the new rules of engagement world. And I think the Republican electorate, as Jay laid out just a few minutes ago, so distrustful of authority, so distrustful of what they term, you know, they would term the Washington establishment, business as usual approach to politics. There's a lot of hunger in that Republican electorate for somebody who was willing to break the rules and go forward. And I do think a lot of Republican voters, you know, do think the rules are kind of rigged against Republicans. They think the media is rigged against Republicans.
Not entirely wrong, incidentally.
And they're not entirely wrong that some of the voting laws are rigged against Republicans. So maybe they think a candidate willing to break the rules, ignore the rules,
right,
is what they, you know, what the Republicans need. Somebody who's not going to let Hillary Clinton play the war on woman game against them, but rather snap right back and go for the jugular. And that's, I think, part of what's happened. There's probably a lot of other things, but those are the ones I'd mention.
I think that's very good. Yeah.
Yeah. Jay. I mean, I agree. I think that the nature of distrust is a very dangerous thing in any organization, in any kind of collective endeavor. We're all working towards a common goal. But you inject distrust and you allow it to spread. The problem with that is that it can go in any direction.
Right.
And it's really striking to me as somebody, you know, for instance, who has written extensively on political corruption and the problem with cronyism in Congress, and sort of seeing like on a policy level, okay, well, these are the good guys and these are the not so good guys and these are the guys that they're terrible. And then, but then you hear this phrase, the establishment. Everybody gets lumped into that, where there's no capacity anymore to distinguish between who are our real friends in government, on who are our real friends in the party and who are not our real friends in the party. And that I think is something that has been happening for a long time. And it is a weakness, an institutional weakness within the party itself. And I think that this is a weakness that Trump has been able to take advantage of.
I think that's very interesting. That's very, for both of you, that's a very, because I mean, I don't think the Democrats, for all their weaknesses, and I think Hillary Clinton is a weak candidate, both in the primaries and the general election. Bernie Sanders, a 74-year-old, 75-year-old now, I think socialist seems ridiculous. But they don't have that problem, I don't think. I think most Democratic primary voters think most Democratic leaders more or less are in sync with them.
Yes.
They should be more aggressive. Maybe some of them have sold out to Wall Street, but they kind of share a basic, don't you think, kind of a common agenda,
well,
and a common
the
view
Democrats,
of where the progressive future is supposed to be. Whereas I do think on the Republican side, this could be a strength, of course, because it means it's in a way a bigger party, maybe. And you could have said this about FDR's party that did the New Deal. Technocrats in Washington share much with the Southern farmers who were voting for FDR. But nonetheless, I think the gulf and then the in and among the factions of the Republican Party is now greater than on the Democratic side. And that is, you see that in this race,
yeah,
don't you think?
Well, and I do think it's a challenge for November, because if you look, you know,
close by discussing November.
Most Republicans, you know, think that the formula for victory is the Reagan coalition. And it's a coalition of strong national security, conservative views on social policy and social issues, and economic growth in the form of tax cuts and reducing the size of government. The problem is, within each of those three pillars, the Republican Party has much greater divides now in terms of the feelings of its voters than it did when Reagan ran. When he ran, not just very wealthy Americans, but middle-income Americans wanted tax cuts. They were all paying a lot of taxes, and the large block of Republican supporters on Main Street were willing to let wealthy Republicans get tax cuts if they got them. Well, those people have gotten a lot of tax cuts now, and they're less, frankly, enthralled with the tax cut platform. In fact, to some extent, they've bought into the notion that the cuts in taxes that will happen in the future are going to help other people, not them. The other thing that, you know, and so on social policy, you have a growing divide between suburban Republicans who on some of the major social issues, have moved away from Reagan's views, whether it's on gay marriage, it's on abortion, and so you have a divide there. And then on national security, you have a growing isolationist wing in the Republican Party who, because of what took place in Iraq and so on, view entanglement in foreign military ventures as being very risky, worrisome, and expensive.
And so, trade and immigration, you have big gulfs between the elites and
I think voters. And so I think it is a bigger, it's a bigger total number of people who can find, I think, a home in the Republican Party, but they may not be willing to tolerate and be willing to, maybe willing to go the other direction because they find things they can't agree with, and the party's having a much harder time holding that big tent together.
I think, and I'll let Jay close with this, conclude on this, but I think, I mean, when you think concretely about either Trump as the nominee, and an awful lot of Republicans having difficulty accepting that, or Trump being defeated for the nomination, I think people who are, I think we are all Trump skeptics, let's say, so we prefer him not to be the nominee, or hostile to Trump even, but of course, practically speaking, what does that look like when Trump, you know, wins X number of states, but Rubio comes on, Cruz gets out, whatever, you know, and at the end he gets beaten? How many unhappy Trump supporters are there? Do they automatically just stick in the Republican column in November? I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
you know, to that, I'm not a big believer in, you know, Walter Dean Burnham's theory of political cycles. But there is an interesting sort of, you know, you look at these great foundational elections, Jefferson in 1800. Well, go forward in time 36 years, 1836, the Jeffersonian coalition was shattered, right? Abraham Lincoln in 1860, you know, Abraham Lincoln managed to unite the West and New England against the South. Go forward 36 years, William Jennings Bryan had, you know, taking the West away. Look at FDR in 1932. You know, once again, a coalition of the West and the South. Scan forward 36 years, Wallace and Humphrey, the coalition had shattered into pieces. You know, political coalitions, they have a shelf life. You know, and a lot of times they have a shelf life because the issues that brought that coalition into being, you know, the coalition is there and it's empowered in government to fix these problems. And then the problems get fixed and it becomes very difficult to continue to run on those issues. You know, you mentioned taxes. Taxes
are... The problems don't get fixed and then people lose
faith in it. So, you know, the distance between Reagan's first election and today is the distance between Thomas Jefferson's election and Martin Van Buren. That's an enormous difference in American history. The distance between Lincoln and Bryan, that is an enormous that's almost two generations of political time having passed. It's an enormous amount of time for a political coalition to maintain itself for that long.
Well, that's a daunting thought, and maybe 2016 therefore becomes, in some odd way or another, a realigning election, or at least a election of crisis and chaos, which often is the prelude, perhaps, to the realigning election. We haven't even talked about third parties or fourth parties if Trump were to be the nominee, or I suppose if Trump were not to be the nominee, incidentally. And we can talk about that in our next conversation, which will happen after we maybe have a better sense of who's going to be the nominee in the Republican Party. I suppose we've been taking for granted that maybe the Democratic Party, that Hillary Clinton just slogs to the nomination. But of course, there are a lot of wild cards in that side of the aisle, indictments and stuff. So that's not so obvious either. So we'll reconvene in 2 or 3 months, decide, maybe we will know by then more or less who the nominees are. But really, we could be looking at 3 or 4 parties, and also a very fluid situation when it comes to the general election. Do we agree on that? That it's not. This is not going to be some cookie cutter.
This is not going to be 1996.
52-48, you know, with a slight change on the margin, depending on the late economic news or whatever. This does seem like a much more fluid and unpredictable,
very much
uncharted waters type election. Well, thank you both for joining me today. I found this stimulating. I've got to think more about a lot of these points, and I hope our viewers learned something from you guys, Spence and Jay. So thanks for being here, and thank you for joining us on Conversations.